The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
The public is invited to the 20th annual Model Train Show presented by the Friends of the Library in Corvallis. The Oregon Electric O Gaugers Train Club returns for its annual Model Train Show. This will be an interactive exhibit that transforms the main library meeting room into a miniature world, complete with multiple tracks, noisy trains, and more. The event will be held Saturday, June 1st from 12 to 6, and on Sunday, June 2nd from 1 to 4 p.m. The Corvallis Benton County Public Library is located at 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue in Corvallis. For more information about the event, you can call 541-766-6793 or check online at cbcpubliclibrary.net.
I got my fare and just a trifle to spare.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre with your Corvallis City Meetings for the week of May 20th, 2024. On Monday, May 20th, the Corvallis City Council will be holding an executive session at 5:15 p.m. to discuss the status of a real estate property transaction. The meeting will be held in person at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. Also on Monday, May 20th, but at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a meeting. The meeting will be held in person at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. See CorvallisOregon.gov for agenda details and information on how to attend the meeting online. On Wednesday, May 22nd at 5 p.m., the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force meeting will be held at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. On Thursday, May 23rd at 4 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a work session which will be held virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. The following is an excerpt from the Associated Press article, What to Expect in Oregon's Primaries, by Leah Askaranam. Primary Day. Oregon's all-male primary will be held on Tuesday. With the exception of Malheur County, all polls close at 8 p.m. Some of Malheur County's polls fall in the Mountain Time Zone, meaning they close an hour earlier, but the county doesn't release results until 9 p.m. local time. What's on the ballot? The Associated Press will provide coverage for the Democratic and Republican presidential primaries, along with primaries for Secretary of State, State Treasurer, and Attorney General. Voters will also select nominees for 23 state House races and 6 state Senate seats. The ballot includes nonpartisan offices, such as county district attorneys and state judges. Former President Donald Trump is running unopposed, though there is a write-in option on both the Democratic and Republican ballots. Biden faces Marianne Williamson. Who gets to vote? In Oregon, political parties can choose who can participate in their primaries, though the two major parties traditionally opt for closed primaries. That means that only voters registered with a political party may participate in that party's primary. Democrats may not vote in the Republican primary or vice versa. Independent or unaffiliated voters may not participate in either primary. Delegate allocation rules. Oregon's 66 pledged Democratic delegates are allocated according to the National Party's standard rules. 15 at-large delegates are allocated in proportion to the statewide vote, as are 7 PLEO delegates, or party leaders and elected officials. the state's 6 congressional districts have a combined 44 delegates at stake, which are allocated in proportion to the vote results in each district. Candidates must receive at least 15% of the statewide vote to qualify for any statewide delegates, and 15% of the vote in a congressional district to qualify for delegates in that district. There are 31 delegates at stake in the Republican presidential primary, all of which go to the winner of the primary. Because Trump is the only Republican on the ballot, he will receive all of the state's GOP delegates. Decision notes. In the 3rd district open seat, there are 5 candidates on the Democratic ballot, though the top 3 fundraisers, Dexter, Jayapal, and Morales, represent parts of Multnomah County, which encompasses nearly all of Portland. While most of Multnomah County falls in the 3rd congressional district, a western sliver falls into the 1st congressional district. Multnomah County runs along the northern border of the district, just south of Vancouver, Washington. In the 4th district, Despain, the chosen candidate of Republican leadership, appears on the ballot alongside Corser. As of the May 1st filing deadline, Despain had raised $273,000, while Corser had raised $27,000. The AP does not make projections and will declare a winner only when it's determined there is no scenario that would allow the trailing candidates to close the gap. If a race has not been called, the AP will continue to cover any newsworthy developments, such as candidate concessions or declarations of victory. In doing so, the AP will make clear that it has not yet declared a winner and explain why. Oregon has automatic recounts if the margin between the top 2 candidates is 0.2% or less. Candidates can request recounts regardless of the margin, but they must pay for them. The AP may declare a winner in a race that is eligible for a recount if it can determine the lead is too large for a recount or legal challenge to change the outcome. What do turnout and advance vote look like? As of April 1st, there were 3,032,333 registered voters in Oregon. Of those, 33% were Democrats and 24% were Republicans. In the 2022 Senate race, turnout was 17% of registered voters in the Democratic primary and 12% in the Republican primary. How long does vote counting usually take? In the 2022 primary election, the AP first reported results at 8:04 p.m. or 4 minutes after polls closed. The election night tabulation ended at 2:48 a.m. with about 77% of total votes counted. Again, this was an excerpt from the article What to Expect in Oregon's Primaries, written by Leah Askaranam with the Associated Press. As for local elections here in our town, there are 3 positions with seats up for grabs, at least that will be on the Tuesday primary. 2 Benton County Commissioner spots are being contended for. Position 2 is up for grabs after Commissioner Zan Ogiero decided not to file to run again. Corvallis City Councilor Gabe Shepard and local loan officer Liz Irish are running for the Democratic seat. With no Republican contenders, whoever wins this Tuesday will effectively be the new commissioner for Position 2. Incumbent Benton County Commissioner Nancy Wise will be defending her Position 3 spot against Republican contender Keith Lemke. They are both running unopposed in their respective parties and may end up competing against each other this November. The final race is for State Representative for Oregon House District 16, for which Sarah Finger McDonald and Sammy L. Abdraba are contending. Ballots are due by 8 p.m. Tuesday evening, and ballot drop-off sites can be found in front of the courthouse in downtown, the Kalapuya Building on Research Way, Gill Coliseum on the OSU campus, the Corvallis Public Library, the Law Enforcement Building on 5th Street, the Corvallis Community Center on Tyler Avenue, and the LBCC Benton Center, among other places. Go to bentoncountyor.gov for a list of more ballot drop-off sites. You're listening to KORC.
Well, good afternoon. This is Dan Krall. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. You can hear this program on Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m. and Mondays 5 to 6. We also archive this news program at our website, korcfm.com. Here's another segment of Civics in Action. I pay attention to little details around town. Things like road signs, stickers that are placed. And here along 4th Street, I can't help but notice the troglodyte vandal has returned. Who's that, you might ask? Somebody's been putting Let's Go Brandon stickers along various public road signs, a blue sticker. Some of you may have seen this along 5th Street. For a time, they were all along like bus signs. I must take credit. I, Dan Kroll, took them down. And I see that the vandal has returned with his very unclever, very not funny sticker. So I'm here to scrape it off. And why? I know it's not my job. But if I call Public Works, I'll get the runaround, say it's ODOT's job because it's along 4th Street. Then I'll call ODOT and I'll leave a message, and no one will ever return my call because nobody checks voicemail anymore. So, and I could be wrong about all that, but I don't think so. Been down that road a few times. I know a quicker way, though, just to do it myself. And this is a small action. I'm not changing the world right now by removing a Let's Go Brandon sticker, but I'm not going to look at this. Look at this. Didn't even put it on right. It's all wadded. As poor as the aesthetic of the phrase itself, Let's Go Brandon. And you know we're going to be stuck with this phrase for years to come due to lack of originality. Due to lack of much sense of humor. And honestly, another reason I'm doing this, I don't think anybody else is going to do this. I don't honestly think anybody else is going to take the time to come and scrape this down. I brought a stepladder. I'm doing this on my own time. As I record this, it's a Tuesday afternoon. It's actually just started raining on me as I'm recording this, but still going to do it. I've removed a number of Let's Go Brandon stickers from various signs, and I'm going to keep doing it. So if you are the person out there who's putting these stickers up, I am happy to counter your efforts. I am thrilled to be the counterbalance to your poor sticker job. And every time I see your stickers, every time, I'm going to take them down. So if you notice these Let's Go Brandon stickers coming and going, I got to take credit where it's due. I'm not trying to brag. But I'd also like to encourage you out there listening. Corvallis is not the city it used to be. It used to be a lot more quaint, a lot more clean. I feel like we've lost our way in a number of ways. But little actions, whether it's picking up garbage off the roadside, helping someone in need, removing Let's Go Brandon stickers, we all play a part. And, I mean, I'm not going to be mad about these stickers. I'm not going to drive past them and say, someone should take that down. I should take it down, and I am. I'm actually walking up to this next sign here, speed limit 25, right near the corner of Polk and 4th. Where a second Let's Go Brandon sticker has been placed. This does not belong. Let's get on my stepladder here and scrape it off. Due to the poor quality of the sticker, it is not scraping off very easily. These are very poor quality print. Not just the message, but the quality itself. I'm slowly scraping it off. It doesn't belong. So back to what I was saying, I really would encourage you. You know various things in this world that need counterbalance, that need someone else to step in. I feel like especially since the pandemic we've seen, we don't have it made. We don't have all the answers and all the resources won't be there. But in little small ways, we can make a difference. Got the sticker about half removed here. Let's go, Brandon. I'm not going to be mad that nobody else is doing it. I'm happy to do this. And I feel like that's kind of where the civics in action really comes in. I know this is not my job, and I don't want to be paid to do this. Yeah, if you're the perpetrator, keep putting them up. I'm going to keep scraping them down every time. And if something happens to me or I become unable to get myself up to scrape these Let's Go Brandon stickers down, I can't do this all by myself, right? If you see a Let's Go Brandon sticker in town, on public property, that is, I wouldn't touch anything on private property. But here's another Let's Go Brandon sticker on the back of this stop sign. And even though my stepladder is sinking into the dirt as I'm trying to get a position here. There we go. Oh, nope. Wow. This mud here is very, it's like quicksand. There we go. Oh, that one just peeled right off. Let's go, Brandon, indeed, right to the trash bin. And I think that's it for now, because I just removed the three I had been looking at. They had just been up for a few days. And this is Dan Krall with Civics in Action. Just successfully removed three stickers that just didn't belong in the public space. And I want to encourage you, find that boldness. What are you afraid of? You know, this life is our one chance to be authentic and just live the life we believe. I certainly don't spend a lot of my time doing just this, but I try to volunteer where I see needs. And I'm not always consistent, right? I don't do it every week. But when I can and when I make intention and time, it feels good to clean up trash, to alleviate problems where I know I can. I cannot solve all the world's problems by any means, but where I can, I'm going to make a difference, and I would encourage you to do the same. Thanks for tuning in today to KORC News, Music, and Civics. You can hear this program Sundays from 1 to 2, Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. on KORC.
You're listening to KORC. The following is a segment from Jeff Tiedrich and his podcast, Everyone is Entitled to My Own Opinion. How many effing flags does Sam Alito salute? It's bad enough for a Supreme Court justice to believe that little Donnie F. Face is a very special boy who deserves to be exempt from all laws. It's bad enough that the same justice is bought and paid for by plutocrats who jet him off to one luxury all-expense-paid vacation after another, with the implicit promise that he'll rule the way they tell him when their cases come before the court. It's bad enough that when it came to strip women of their right to health care, this same justice cited the medieval ravings of some god-mad 17th century zealot who presided over witch trials, for F's sake. That's right. Pregnant women are now bleeding out in emergency rooms all over America because of the pig ignorant beliefs of some misogynist diphthong whose life's work was to hunt down witches. I mean women who talk too loudly. And it's bad enough that 11 days after the failed coup of January 6th, this blank bag hung an insurrectionist-loving flag on his front lawn. Now we're learning that this loathsome creep has been flying a second flag at his beach house, a flag that celebrates Christian nationalism, the effed-up, beyond-belief notion that God Almighty intended America to be a Christian nation ruled by biblical laws, and all the other religions can go F themselves. This time, it was the quote-unquote appeal to heaven flag, which, like the inverted U.S. flag, was carried by rioters at the Capitol on January 6, 2021. Also known as the Pine Tree Flag, it dates back to the Revolutionary War, but largely fell into obscurity until recent years and is now a symbol of support for former President DJT for a religious strand of the quote-unquote Stop the Steal campaign and for a push to remake American government in Christian terms. Hey, heaven-appealing Sammy, is this flag also your wife's fault? The dumbest effing people in the world are all over social media right now, blithering about how, oh no, no, it's a Revolutionary War flag. How could you accuse Sam Alito of having some darker intent? Oh, sure, and the swastika is a Sanskrit symbol for well-being. That's why the Nazis adopted it, because they were so into ancient Near Eastern culture. Yeah, that checks out. You know, it's pretty weird how Sam Alito, a 74-year-old dude, is so steeped in the knowledge of arcane extreme right symbolism. Alito sold off his Budweiser stock after transphobes called for the beer to be boycotted. He's obviously gorging himself on a steady diet of far-right media. How soon before a photo of him wearing a MAGA cap surfaces? How about some spray-painted gold sneakers, Sam? Have you bought yours yet? Speaking of soon, why the F did it take 4 years for us to learn that Steel Stoppin' Sammy hung an insurrectionist flag days after January 6? Wouldn't this have been handy information for the public to have had, say, 4 years ago? And now we learn that Sammy's been hanging a Christian nationalist flag outside his beach house for at least a year. Here's an idea for our worthless scribblers of the press. How about, oh, I don't know, reporting on this stuff when it happens? Isn't it important for people to know that a Supreme Court justice is a white supremacist? What the F, media? Did you know that Holy Mike Johnson flies the same flag outside his congressional office door? These flags are very public FUs. It's not enough for Christian Nation Sammy to hold these abhorrent beliefs. No, he's got to rub your face in it. Alito is just another MAGA troll. This Supreme Court is broken because it's not just Fish and Trip Sammy who's a problem. We have money-grubbing Clarence, who is so blood-sucking greedy that he threatened to quit the court if someone didn't grease his palm pronto. Up stepped Nazi memorabilia-loving Harlan Crow, who now underwrites the luxe lifestyles of both Clarence and his insurrection-planning, election-denying spouse. We also have Beer Heart Brett, who was so blackout drunk all the way through prep school and college that he literally has no idea how many women he assaulted. Who paid off his debts? Who paid for his country club membership? We'll probably never find out. Then there's Nihilist Neil, a bomb thrower who hates the very idea of government. According to Neil, government should exist only to pay his salary, I guess. And let's not forget Aunt Lydia Comey Barrett. Don't be fooled by the sometimes sensible words that tumble out of her mouth. In her heart, she's still a dyed-in-the-wool religious extremist. Her fingerprints are all over the Dobbs decision. And we have useless John Roberts, the ineffectual Chief Justice who lets these rogue justices walk all over him. Hey, let's check in on Dick Durbin. He's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's got the power to hold Alito accountable. I'll bet he's hopping mad over this. I'll bet he intends to drag Sammy before the entire committee and headline. Key Senate Democrat doesn't plan to probe Justice Alito over upside-down flag. Judiciary Committee Chair Dick Durbin said there's not much to be gained with a hearing. An upside-down flag outside Alito's home drew criticism from senators, including Republicans. Oh my God, what are you doing, Dick? Not much to be gained? Are you effing serious? What is this tepid, let's just shrug our shoulders because what you gonna do bullcrap? The American public understood what he did. What? Just because we heard about it, that lets him off the hook? No, we understand what Alito did and we demand action. Right now, there's an election-denying, insurrectionist-loving Christian nationalist sitting on the court, poised to make dear leader's assertion that laws are bullcrap and I should get to crime all I want a reality. Is that what you want, Dick Durbin? Enough with these weak tea calls for recusal. Alito isn't going to recuse. He believes he's on a mission from God to save America from the unwashed heathen horde. If you're a God-bothering zealot, you don't recuse yourself from a holy war. Calls for Steele, Stop, and Sammy to resign are equally futile. It's never going to happen. Congress needs to impeach Sam Alito's insurrectionist ass. It all starts with you, Dick Durbin. Hear that phone ringing? America is calling. That was a segment from Jeff Tiedrich's Everyone is Entitled to My Own Opinion. You can get more information on Jeff Tiedrich and his opinion at www.jefftiedrich.com. That's JEFFTIEDRICH.com. You're listening to KORC.
Do you love live music? Live local music? Well, that's what you'll find July 27th and 28th at the free Corvallis Celtic Festival in Central Park. Having a large local festival with local music means we need volunteers to make it run. Help your local Celtic festival by volunteering for a two-hour shift. You'll help the festival succeed, and you'll get to hear great music at the same time. Volunteer for the Corvallis Celtic Festival at corvallisceltic.org/volunteer. Wasn't that easy?
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. Hi, everyone. This is JC, and I'm sitting here today near the Saturday Market talking with Hezekiah, a local musician here. He's testing out his drums to see how the sound is. Because it's cooler out today, he's checking how tight the drums are. So Hezekiah, you mentioned something earlier about coming here to the Saturday Market and being in a different spot, and now you feel like you're a lot of musicians here are kind of isolated and put back away from the crowd. How long have you been coming to the market like this, playing your drums?
I've been in Corvallis for 15 years, and not until probably about 7 or 8 years into me being here did I start to like, I had the right setup, so I played in the market, something that's serene and beautiful for a couple years, and then COVID hit, and then I started playing right here.
Okay, so when you say right here, for those of you that can't see us, we're off Monroe, and we're back behind the main walking area of the market amongst the trees. Last time I saw you, we were at the dedication to the new skate bowl. And you said something that I thought was really important about culture. Do you remember that at all?
Just the culture of skateboarding, which is, then we'll talk about skateboarding, then that's usually a basically super counterculture, and the people that come down there are of different thoughts, and also people who drink and smoke down there is basically rebels and outlaws and so on and so forth like that, and even little kids. But as of the, I'm originally from Michigan and coming to Oregon, how much there is not that much culture here because it's a lot of it's basically cowboys and red-bearded lumberjacks and all that stuff. So the stuff that I'm doing is invoking a different kind of culture because I'm thinking the culture that's perpetuating is predominantly rock and roll, punk, and folk. And that has not manifested anything, you know, like no gods coming down to earth or anything like that. So if we keep on perpetuating that, we're going to have the same results. Same thing with the politicians, same thing with the religions. Keep on chanting those mantras to like a god that's went offline and expected something to happen out of it.
So you mentioned also how the skate bowl and just the culture of the skateboarding brings a positivity to that area that it needs too. I remember you saying something about that.
Well, yeah, because that area is basically looks like a bomb went off and there's garbage and there's people yelling, there's people ODing. And when I used to be here, everybody was just down by the river, like jumping in their neck and all that stuff. We didn't have to worry about like camps and all that stuff. You can go for a walk without, you know, hearing, you know, the death knell of the failed society. So it has changed a lot. And then their solution now right now is basically is sweep people all over the place and be like live in the parks. And parks are meant for like people playing frisbee and kids playing all that stuff. And why then also like they want people being in the parks, but they don't provide a actual legitimate spot or any porta potty. So it's basically like sleep in the park where kids play and take dumps in the grass.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I know they've got that hotel.
Yeah, I'm at the motel right now, but that's going to be demolished June 30th. It's going to turn into, that was going to be a transitional house, and then it's going to turn into a 30 to 50 unit permanent supportive housing. Yeah, the mixture of permanent supportive housing and tiny houses are 100% success, and they're spending about $30,000 every time they sweep people. That could have been used basically to get people rehabilitated on their foot. I've seen people once they got a shower and a toilet, within 2 weeks they look like a new person.
Absolutely. So you also work at the drop-in center. Tell us a little bit about that and your work there.
Basically, I was going to the drop-in center since I've been here, and it's been many different locations, and then I joined the board, and then during COVID, I became a volunteer. Then I became staff. Basically, a drop-in center is basically a hub to get people connected to services, and we don't force people to do anything. They get connected to service. They can get the bare essentials, like, you know, a sack, lunch, clothing, whatever we get donated and all that stuff. And then it's also a place where people can just, you know, connect with other people in the neighborhood.
That's really cool. And you're one of the staff now, you said.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. When I first got there, all I had was like peanut butter and jelly and like minor services, but they hired a new executive director. So we've been basically, COVID happened and the city basically was just like not there. And we basically improvise and pull stuff together. And this most recent ice storm, the city was basically like, here you go. We're not going to do anything. And it's throwing all the burdens on our community. And like, and the community is overburdened. If COVID didn't happen, I see the old people who are volunteering, they're like in their 70s, 80s, they wouldn't be able to deal with the new batch of people that are like, after COVID, like, and then fentanyl and all that stuff, it's like heightened everyone's mental health. And it's like, it's off the chain out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you help people get resources that they normally couldn't get.
No, they could get them, but the rigmarole and the paperwork and
gotcha.
The discrimination and the phone calls and the system, like, basically makes it hard for anyone to get on their foot. If someone wants to get drug treatment, they got to wait 6 months. If someone wants to get off alcohol, they got to wait 6 months. So when someone's trying to do right, they make it really hard for them to get right.
Now, what do you think about that new crisis center that's going up?
It's only going to be like 6 beds. The drop-in center was in the bill with the new Justice Center, and they're basically going to get a new Justice Center. We're going to get our Navigation Center to expand. Right now, we're going to fit like 15 people in our building. We got this really small building, and we are just overburdened. It was going to be the jail and us, and we're in the same bill, but most people voted against that bill because, like, mm-hmm. the jail was getting like 97 million, and we're getting like 3 million. People was like, nah, we're doing the stuff that the jail's not doing, like trying to get people out of jail, transition into something, get them to housing, trying to get people a warm handoff. They like kick someone out of jail or a mental facility and then put them right on the streets, and it's like then they end up back into the
exactly.
same cycle.
Exactly. It's that cyclical thing. It just goes around and around and around. So it sounds like you know the system pretty well.
I don't know all the jargon and the acronyms, but I work with a lot of people. I was trying to do like independent street work with people that were basically like, I crashed with a woman that like people were stealing from her and like leaving bloody needles on the front porch. And after that, like, I start teaming with people because it was like, you can't do it like by yourself. So
right.
team with people that know this and know all this stuff. And they bring me to me so I actually know what's going on, and I'm intelligent enough, but some of the stuff they be saying is like, you know, why are you making the language all obscure for people to not even know what the hell they're talking about? Paperwork is like that too. Like, as paperwork is like, even me, like, paperwork is like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, it is complicated, and it's long-winded. When did you start getting into drumming?
I came here originally playing a bugle, and then a guy that will be coming and playing with me later, this guy Dave Storrs, he recognized soon as I played the drums that like I was built for it, and portion of my past is playing basketball, so it reminds me of playing basketball. And then he taught me this the rudiments of it, and then I started researching further about, you know, Santeria, Capoeira, and I don't count or anything like that, but I've been
okay.
The drums are, I don't have to think as much. With the horn, I got to think about A, B, C, D, and G and all that stuff. But with the drums, it's just like, that's where the voodoo and the trance comes from.
Gotcha.
Like, then you're going to start to invoking the gods, which for me, it takes, you know, over 5 hours. Like, that's why at about 2 hour mark, I'm just like, then my body is able to do the stuff that I wanted to do. And people don't really have that much time, you know. Luckily, at the Old Rodeo, they give you 3 hours for a performance. So when I play there, If I start off, you know, without that much momentum, by the time the second set, then I'm cooking.
As a frequent attendee of the Saturday Market, I really love hearing your drums. It sounds like a song that somebody who's not aware of how drumming works and the syncopation and all of that. Sometimes you'll have a guitarist here, and sometimes it'll just be you or someone else is playing next to you, playing the drums. So it's really nice to be able to hear that. It's not, because at the Saturday Market, people will play their instruments, right? And they just play sometimes the same ones over and over. Or they bring their amplifiers. You don't need any of that.
Yeah, I think that's a no-no down here. This guy set up the other day, go right by me. Knew I was over here and started doing the amplifier, and then we had to tell them to leave. But there's not a lot of variety here. Like, there's usually mainly like little kids on violins, and then the folk band, or it's usually typical Corvallis. They're not really intimidated or discriminating stuff that has no genre or is rooted in something else. I mean, they act like they want diversity, act like they want that, but they keep on booking the same stuff, and people want better. People want a lot better in a lot of things. With that skate park thing, I was supposed to DJ. All the kids love hip-hop. I go down there and play hip-hop, and then the person that booked it booked all nothing but punk. So they're like sort of just out of touch with actuality and all that stuff. I mean, when you guys do fundraisers, who do you guys book? Make mixes and stuff like that too, so I'm going to eventually give a USB to one of my friends, Lauren, that does DJ stuff.
So tell me more about the mix that you say that you... Are you DJ?
Not really, because I don't have records. I basically just bootleg everything off of YouTube, and I got a whole bunch of channels, and I mainly, like, narrow down the search. So I just, like, there's gamelan music, Australian music, a lot of, Japanese geisha music. I like early honky tonk. Any European gypsy music.
Okay.
Sorts of African music, but like field recordings, like obscure African, not like some Ladysmith, Black Mambazo, this like commercial sort of stuff. Afrobeat, all sorts of capoeira stuff, and early blues, earlier jazz. And the person that made me delve into different kind of music, because I grew up on basically, you know, R&B, funk, soul, and
yep.
Hip hop.
Yep.
I listened to Sade first, and I was like, whoa. And then we had a radio station, a college radio station, WCBN in Ann Arbor, and I heard Sun Ra for the first time. And I was just like, after that, I was just like, I didn't believe that kind of music exists. Because when people, I play Sun Ra for people, they'd be like, that's not jazz. It was like, because he has these drowsy horn melodies and drums and all this stuff. And everyone knows Miles Davis and John Coltrane, which makes me cringe. I don't dislike those, but it was like when I mentioned Sun Ra, like, who's Sun Ra? I was like, Facebook now. I got a number, and you can message me.
Very cool. So what's your profile name on Facebook?
It's just my regular name, Hezekiah Franklin.
Franklin. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So listeners, if you're interested in learning more about Hezekiah, his music, his philosophy, he has some wonderful ideas that I would love to go down a rabbit hole with him on. But anyway, check out his Facebook page, Hezekiah Franklin. So we're going to listen to a little bit of Hezekiah's music. Hezekiah, thank you so much. Was Hezekiah Franklin, who's an artist when it comes to drumming and syncopation. You can find him every Saturday at the Saturday Market, sometimes with a guitarist and sometimes just on his own. He has multiple drums, and once he gets going and warmed up, his music is incredible. He's also a staff member at the Drop-In Center, and a strong advocate for people with mental health disorders and people without homes. He's going to be performing on Wednesday, May 22nd, at the Old World Deli with his friend DJ Nails doing a DJ mix. Also, on Friday, May 31st, the Drop-In Center will be hosting an art gallery featuring much of the artistry and visual arts from people who need the services of the Drop-In Center. You might be surprised at some of the incredible art that you will see. It will be across the street from the Drop-In Center starting at noon on Friday, May 31st at 523 Northwest 4th Street. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics.
Oregon established vote by mail as the standard mechanism for voting with Ballot Measure 60, a citizens' initiative, in 1998. The measure made Oregon the first state in the United States to conduct its elections exclusively by mail. However, Oregon Republicans, perhaps tiring of almost never winning statewide offices in our blue state, filed a lawsuit arguing that Oregonians suffer from a crisis of confidence in their election system and that election officials have violated the 14th Amendment by using electronic vote tabulation equipment. Last week, the United States Supreme Court, yes, that court, denied a request to hear a case seeking to overturn Oregon's mail-in voting system, officially putting an end to the lawsuit. Despite Oregon voters' reliance on mail-in voting, voters brought this lawsuit. Yes, we can safely say a few Republican voters, led by Republican Mark Thielman, who ran for election for governor of Oregon but lost in the Republican primary in May 2022. As evidence of the claims that Oregonians suffer from this crisis of confidence, the plaintiff cited the debunked right-wing propaganda movie 2000 Mules, which they claim shows for everyone to see illegal ballot trafficking during the 2020 election. Actually, Mr. Thielman, it does not show that. Plaintiffs also argued that every phantom vote cast disenfranchises a legitimate vote and requested that the court overturn the state's mail-in voting system. Last summer, the district court dismissed the lawsuit, but the plaintiffs appealed to the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which subsequently dismissed the case in December. In their petition to the Supreme Court, the plaintiffs asked the court to address if they had the ability to bring the lawsuit as it was previously dismissed on standing grounds. The court declined to take up this request. In 2001, Oregon became the country's first universal mail-in voting state and has since been consistently high-ranked in terms of voter turnout. Mr. Thielman, the crisis is a crisis of ridiculous claims by failed Republican candidates. Overturning this system would be detrimental to Oregon voters who have voted by mail for decades. As former Governor Kate Brown wrote for Democracy Docket in 2020, when it comes to mail-in voting, Oregon is that friend who listened to music from bands before they were cool. We were the first state to conduct elections exclusively by mail. Since 2000, Oregon has mailed registered voters a ballot for every election. This policy change, made possible by a citizens' ballot initiative passed in 1998, has revolutionized democratic participation in our state and helped make elections more accessible. The Republican plaintiffs allege that the mantra of those who defend the current systems is that there's no evidence of fraud. But at the same time, they fail to show the public what is happening inside the black box machines that count the vote. Oregon is not the only state where mail-in voting and voting in many circumstances is under attack. Part of the right-wing crisis includes a suit filed on behalf of three voters with print disabilities and two blind advocacy groups against California Secretary of State Shirley Weber, a Democrat, challenging California's requirement to return mail-in ballots by paper-based methods. Print disabilities include blindness, visual impairment, intellectual disabilities, and other impairments that prevent a voter from reading, marking, or handling a paper ballot on their own, although voters with these disabilities can mark their ballots electronically. The, again, Republican plaintiffs allege this requirement is inaccessible to some blind voters who need accommodations to electronically submit their ballots. In Michigan, a lawsuit filed by the Republican National Committee, the Michigan Republican Party, the National Republican Congressional Committee, and others against Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat, and Michigan Director of Elections Jonathan Brader challenging the state's absentee ballot signature verification system. There's more. In Alabama, a lawsuit filed on behalf of five Alabama civil rights organizations against Republican Alabama Attorney General and the Republican District Attorneys for several counties challenging several provisions of Senate Bill 1, a new law that makes it illegal for individuals and organizations to assist voters in submitting their absentee ballots. Missouri, Texas, Arkansas, and Florida have all had similar voting challenges. Protect your right to vote by voting. Your next opportunity is in November. For KORC, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
I know, you're scared. You're worried that for some reason, someday, you'll have to journey beyond the few precious square miles that KORC can be heard from. No one knows what's outside our protective news, music, and civics low-power FM force field. Dragons? Robots? Commercial radio? What's a long-time listener, first-time caller to do? Well, if you have an Apple device, you can now listen to KORC from anywhere in the world. Download it from the Apple App Store for iPhone, iPad, and Macs today.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Power and corruption abuse that comes with any power are manifested in different ways and areas in the Israeli society as in any other society. But the Israeli domination over the Palestinians has been the most vile, cruel, destructive, and dangerous of all, and the least covered by the Israeli press in general.
Longtime Israeli journalist Amira Haas, as Israel intensifies its attacks on Gaza, and South Africa calls on the International Court of Justice to order Israel to halt its assault on Rafah, we spend the hour with Haaretz correspondent Amira Haas, the only Israeli Jewish journalist to have spent 30 years living in and reporting from Gaza and the West Bank. This week, she addressed the graduating class of the Columbia Journalism School. Many of the student journalists there threatened with arrest as they dared to go outside their doors to cover what was happening on the Columbia campus, with well over 100 students arrested as a Gaza solidarity encampment.
The journalism that I chose to practice is based on the refusal to see injustice as normal, the refusal to normalize it to a point that we do not see it. This is exactly what the students here in Colombia and in so many other campuses in the US and now in Europe have been doing. Refuse to accept hell as normal.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's deadly attacks throughout the Gaza Strip are intensifying, with thousands more Palestinians in northern Gaza now cut off from food and water, as Israel says its troops are fighting in Jabalia's city center. Israel's attacks on Rafah are also ongoing, after more than a half a million people taking refuge in the southern city were forced to flee. The U.S. said its first aid shipments have started via its temporary Gaza pier after several weeks of construction. But the U.N. reiterated that all humanitarian access points to Gaza need to be opened up.
To stave off the horrors of famine, we must use the fastest and most obvious route to reach the people of Gaza. And for that, we need access by land.
That was the UN Secretary General's deputy spokesperson, Farhan Haq. Many Gazans have rejected the U.S. pier. These are displaced Palestinians in Nuseirat.
We don't want ships. We want the border crossing to open for people to come and go. We want safety. We want official borders. Those planes as well that they bring here with the parachutes and they throw food at us like dogs, like beggars. That does not work. It falls on houses. It falls on people. It brings us problems.
We reject dealing with the ships and the American ships because in the same way it gives us, it will take away from us. Maybe they want to take over the gas fields that are in the sea, or maybe they are here to displace the Palestinian people and to transfer people from one country to another.
Spain has denied port access to an Israeli-bound ship from India carrying explosives. Spain says it will no longer allow ships with weapons for Israel to use its ports. Spain has also vowed to recognize Palestinian statehood by July. Foreign ministers from 13 countries signed onto a letter warning Israel to halt its ground operations in Rafah and to get more aid to Palestinians. The letter was signed by all G7 members, minus the United States, Germany, France, the UK, Italy, Japan, and Canada, as well as the foreign ministers of Australia, Denmark, the Netherlands, New Zealand, South Korea, and Sweden. In The Hague, the International Court of Justice has ordered representatives for Israel to submit more information about humanitarian conditions in its so-called evacuation zones in Gaza by tomorrow. The request came as the ICJ closed its second day of hearings on South Africa's request for emergency measures to halt Israel's assault on Rafah. Israel denied its carrying out a genocide in Gaza as it addressed the court today. Briefings were halted for a moment when a protester yelled liars as the Israeli delegation spoke. Yesterday, South Africa presented its case.
Israel's genocide has continued apace and has just reached a new and horrific stage. Israel has sought to hide its crimes through the weaponization of international humanitarian law. It pretends that the civilians it ruthlessly kills through its 2,000-pound bombs, through its targeted airstrikes, through its artificial intelligence systems, through its executions, are human shields.
We'll have more on the World Court hearings later in the broadcast. Police continued their violent crackdown and student Gaza solidarity protests this week with arrests and raids Thursday at University of California, Berkeley, as well as DePaul University in Chicago. This is DePaul student body president Parveen Mundi.
It's really important to us that, you know, for the people of Palestine, knowing that, you know, I'm a student body president and I go to a university, and at the same time, there are no universities left in Gaza. We're all responsible for making sure that our tuition dollars aren't going towards genocide.
Faculty at Morehouse College, a historically black college in Atlanta, Georgia, voted 50-38 in favor of conferring an honorary doctorate to President Biden when he delivers a commencement speech on Sunday. Biden's visit to Morehouse has been met with protests from students over his response to what's happening in Gaza. In New York State, students at Bard College have just taken over the school's administration building. Meanwhile, Columbia students and faculty on Thursday celebrated an alternative people's graduation at the nearby Cathedral of St. John the Divine. We'll have more from that ceremony later in the broadcast. This comes as the Washington Post reports a group of billionaires and business interests privately pressured New York City Mayor Eric Adams to deploy police on pro-Palestinian protests at Columbia University. A WhatsApp group with some of the country's wealthiest people detailed donations to Adams' campaign and conversations with the mayor. Some of those involved include real estate magnate Barry Sternlicht, Daniel Lubetsky, founder of the Kind Snacks brand, hedge fund manager Daniel Loeb, and founder of Thor Equities, Joseph Sitt. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected a challenge to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's funding mechanism that could have undermined the agency charged with protecting borrowers from predatory loans and other abuses by banks and financial entities. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich praised the justices for protecting the CFPB from, quote, attacks by shady payday lenders, adding since 2011, the CFPB has put $17.5 billion back in the pockets of 200 million Americans who have been defrauded, unquote. In other Supreme Court news, the New York Times is reporting an upside-down U.S. flag, which is a symbol used by Trump supporters and election deniers, hung outside the home of Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito in January 2021, just days before Biden's inauguration. The revelations are expected to reignite calls for Justice Alito to recuse himself from cases related to the January 6th insurrection, including Trump's attempt to claim immunity from election subversion charges. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has pardoned Daniel Perry, the U.S. Army sergeant who was convicted and sentenced to 25 years for murdering Black Lives Matter protester Garrett Foster in 2020. Ahead of the murder, Perry posted on social media he planned to shoot, quote, looters, and posted dozens of racist and Islamophobic messages and images. While people with felonies are not permitted to own firearms in Texas, Governor Abbott's pardon means Perry will be legally allowed to carry and possess a gun. In other news from Texas, at least four people are dead, nearly a million are without power, after heavy rains and powerful storms battered the Houston area Thursday night, causing massive floods and destruction. The Biden administration's moving to end all new coal leasing in the Powder River Basin of Wyoming and Montana, the largest coal-producing region in the United States. The move comes in response to a lawsuit by environmental groups. Meanwhile, in Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has signed a bill that removes all references to climate change in state law and weakens regulations on pipelines, among other measures. The move eliminates climate change as a priority in Florida's energy policy decisions, despite Florida being on the front lines of the climate crisis as it faces worsening hurricanes, rising sea levels, extreme heat, and toxic algae blooms. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, families gathered Wednesday to bury nearly two dozen children who were killed earlier this month after rocket attacks on camps for displaced people near the city of Goma. Another 13 victims, mostly women, were also buried. Mourners blame the M23 armed group for the killings and condemn neighboring Rwanda for backing the group. This is Congolese Human Rights Minister Albert Fabrice Puela.
A Congolese genocide for economic reasons is being perpetrated in our country by Rwanda. War crimes, such as those of May 3rd and Mugunga, crimes against humanity, have all been documented.
Rwanda has denied the accusation, saying the attacks were likely carried out by militias backed by the Congolese army. Intensifying violence in the eastern DRC has forced hundreds of thousands to flee as armed groups vie for control of the country's natural resources.
There are a lot of foreign countries behind Rwanda President Paul Kagame, and they're killing my people because of the minerals that the Congo has. If they want to work with the Congo, they shouldn't go through Kagame. Let them come and negotiate with us, and we'll know how to make the ore available to them so that we can all benefit from it.
In other news about Rwanda, Human Rights Watch said Rwandan immigration authorities denied entry to one of its researchers this week. Human Rights Watch said the move, quote, exposes the government's deep-seated hostility to human rights monitoring and independent scrutiny of any kind, unquote. Back in the U.S., immigrant rights groups continue to demand the Biden administration immediately halt deportations to Haiti and enact protections for Haitian migrants as the island nation faces a worsening humanitarian crisis, deepening gang violence and political instability. Advocates said Thursday another group of Haitian asylum seekers have been deported, the second deportation flight since April. The Haitian Bridge Alliance said the, quote, deeply troubling policy places vulnerable individuals in grave danger, unquote. And the Biden administration took a major step towards reclassifying marijuana from Schedule 1 drug to Schedule 3. The move will not decriminalize marijuana, but acknowledges its medical benefits and differentiates it from lethal drugs like heroin or meth. The move would also ease tax burdens on states that have legalized marijuana sales. Biden hailed the monumental step Thursday.
No one should be in jail merely for using or possessing marijuana, period. Far too many lives have been upended because of failed approach to marijuana, and I'm committed to righting those wrongs.
As a senator, Joe Biden authored the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, enacting new mandatory minimum sentences for drugs, including marijuana. The law led to a fivefold increase in the jailing of black people. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
Where you go, I will go, my friend. Where you go, I will go. Where you go, I will go, my friend. Where you go, I will go. 'Cause your people are my people. Your people are mine. Your people are my people. Our struggles align.
Where you go, I will go, sung by the Liberated Zone, a folk troupe that began when the members were part of the Gaza Solidarity encampment at Columbia University. They sang the song while they were being arrested by the NYPD. They performed Thursday at the People's Graduation, a gathering for justice and peace at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
That was a segment from Democracy Now!, which aired on Friday, May 17th, 2024. For more national and international news, go to democracynow.org. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. KORC is privileged to offer segments of Democracy Now! This segment is from Friday, May 24th, 2024.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! More than 1,000 Harvard students walk out of their graduation in protest over 13 undergrads who were barred from graduating after they took part in a Gaza Solidarity encampment on campus. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers grill the presidents of UCLA, Rutgers, and Northwestern universities about pro-Palestine protests on campus. One Northwestern professor was singled out for criticism.
Let me ask you about Stephen Thrasher, who's one of the goons in the photo behind me. He's a professor of journalism at Northwestern. He and several of your faculty members locked arms. They scuffled with police officers, blocked the police officers on your campus.
Well,
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In central Gaza, generators at Al-Aqsa Hospital and Deir al-Balah have reportedly gone out, as the hospital warns there's no fuel left to power generators, and without electricity, quote, all patients will be condemned to death, unquote. On Thursday, Al-Aqsa Hospital treated dozens of Palestinians injured in an Israeli shelling on a welfare ministry site. 12 people were killed in that attack.
Most of the bodies were burnt. More than 30 wounded arrived at this hospital. This hospital in a few hours will not be functioning because of the lack of fuel for the generator. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital is the only one hospital that is functioning in central Gaza.
In the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, the last two hospitals still treating patients remain under a days-long Israeli siege. This comes as the Israeli military says the bodies of three hostages were recovered in the refugee camp. They're believed to have been killed in the October 7th attack, then brought into Gaza. In the south, Israeli ground forces continue to advance in Rafah, which has now been decimated despite once being designated as a safe area. The UN warns over 900,000 Gazans, nearly half the population, has been forcibly displaced in the past few weeks and do not have access to shelter, food, water, and other essentials. In diplomatic news, the Agence France-Presse reports CIA chief William Burns is headed to Paris in hopes of reviving ceasefire talks. Meanwhile, the International Court of Justice is expected to rule shortly on South Africa's request to order a halt to Israel's assault on Rafah. A House panel held another hearing Thursday on student Palestinian solidarity protests with the heads of Northwestern University, Rutgers, and the University of California, Los Angeles. While Republican lawmakers again sought to amplify alleged anti-Semitism on campuses, Minnesota Congressmember Ilhan Omar questioned UCLA Chancellor Gene Block on failing to protect his students when a violent pro-Israeli mob, many of them outsiders, attacked peaceful protesters.
Because of your inaction, they acted on the intention and brutally attacked students you were responsible for. This happened in front of your eyes, on your campus, and it was live streamed for the whole world to see. So I would like to know if you are truly committed to keeping your students safe, how did you fail these students at many critical points where you could have intervened?
So, thank you for the question, but I'm sorry, but I reject the premise. These students.
How do you reject the premise? Are these pictures lying? Are any of these people in jail?
The mob attacked the pro-Palestinian students at the encampment with metal bars and two-by-fours. We'll have more on this hearing after headlines with Northwestern professor Steve Thrasher. As the hearing was unfolding in Capitol Hill, police in riot gear stormed UCLA's campus just after hundreds of students set up another encampment and took over a campus building. Meanwhile, in Massachusetts, over 1,000 Harvard graduates walked out of their commencement ceremony Thursday. Many chanted, "Let them walk," in reference to the 13 students not allowed to graduate in retaliation for their involvement with campus protests. Speakers at the ceremony also addressed the issue.
While these students may not leave with the degrees they rightfully earn, they will walk out of Harvard's gates with something far more important: a clear conscience and a proof of resolute commitment to humanity. Take courage from their steadfastness and honor their sacrifice by using your degree to speak out for the oppressed.
In international news, German police detained at least 130 people after raiding a peaceful pro-Palestine occupation at Humboldt University in Berlin. Students are calling on the university to, quote, take an active role in ending the genocide against the people of Palestine and their decades-long suffering, unquote. President Biden said he'll designate Kenya as a non-NATO ally. As President William Ruto visited the White House Thursday, the largely symbolic title was announced as Kenya prepares to deploy its forces to Haiti as part of an international security mission. The U.S. has pledged to contribute money, logistical support, and equipment. Biden justified the U.S. involvement in Haiti during a joint press conference with Kenyan President Ruto.
Haiti is in a
area of the Caribbean that is very volatile. There's a lot going on in this hemisphere, and we're in a situation where we want to do all we can without us looking like America once again is stepping over and deciding this is what must be done.
Meanwhile, in Kenya, police are violently cracking down on environmental activists in the village of Ayumbo as they protest the construction of a nuclear reactor. At least three people were arrested on Tuesday. Last night, President Biden held a state dinner for Kenyan President Ruto. Among those who attended were two past presidents, Bill Clinton and President Obama, whose father was Kenyan. In Papua New Guinea, over 100 people are feared dead after a catastrophic landslide in the northern Enga province. Homes were flattened by rocks, soil and trees after the side of a mountain collapsed. The search for survivors continues. The United Nations has approved a resolution declaring July 11th an International Day of Remembrance for the 1995 Srebrenica genocide. Some 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys were killed in the massacre after Bosnian Serb armed forces stormed the UN safe zone during the Balkan Wars, seen as the worst atrocity in Europe's history since World War II. The resolution was sponsored by Germany and Rwanda. Both Serbia and Bosnian Serbs have denied that genocide happened in Srebrenica. The resolution does say Serbs are responsible for the massacre. French President Emmanuel Macron described the recent upheaval in New Caledonia as a, quote, unprecedented insurrection movement as he visited the archipelago on Thursday. Macron said he would delay new reforms that would give voting rights to French residents of the territory, a move that the indigenous Kanak population argues will dilute their voice and their struggle for independence. This is French President Macron.
Deuxièmement, dès que les retraits seront effectifs et observés.
This reform, although it's rejected by some here, which has fed the violence, it has democratic legitimacy. The bill proposed by the government has been voted with a clear majority, both in the National Assembly and the Senate. I say this as president. We don't just throw away popular sovereignty like a mere piece of paper.
Back in the United States, the Supreme Court Thursday approved a South Carolina congressional map that a lower court previously ruled was racially gerrymandered and constituted a, quote, bleaching of African-American voters from a district. In a scathing dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote the decision will give state lawmakers, quote, an incentive to use race as a proxy to achieve partisan ends, she said. In abortion news, Louisiana's Republican-led legislature voted to classify abortion pills as controlled substances. Republican Governor Jeff Landry is expected to sign the measure into law, meaning the possession of abortion pills without a prescription could soon be a crime in Louisiana, with penalties including jail time and fines. Mifepristone and misoprostol have been deemed safe by the FDA and do not lead to abuse or dependency, they have found. The drugs are also used for purposes other than abortion, which is already widely banned in Louisiana. This is Tyler Barberin with the Louisiana Abortion Fund.
It's going to mean detrimental things, and there are going to be very specific types of people that are circumstanced into carrying pregnancies that they don't consent to or did not want because of legislation like that, like this. And that, unfortunately, will most likely be poor Black communities that we represent and that we do our work to support.
In related news, nearly 6,000 doctors have signed a letter urging the Supreme Court to uphold the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. The federal law protects the rights of pregnant people to get the emergency medical care they need. The National Collegiate Athletic Association and the five most powerful athletic conferences agreed to an historic $2.8 billion settlement, paving the way for college athletes to be directly compensated for the first time ever. The deal, which must still be approved by a judge, would provide back pay to athletes as well as allow colleges to pay their players up to $20 million per student going forward. Critics say the deal is flawed and risks creating gender-based pay inequalities and will disadvantage smaller conferences. The Justice Department
29 states and District of Columbia sued Ticketmaster and its owner, Live Nation, for exercising a monopoly over the live entertainment ticket prices and crushing competition. The lawsuit is calling for Live Nation, which controls around 80% of major concert venues, to be broken up. Norfolk Southern will pay the government a $15 million fine for last year's derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, which caused a massive explosion and the release of toxic chemicals. Norfolk Southern also agreed to spend $500 million to complete safety improvements and address health concerns in the affected communities. Last month, the company settled a $600 million class action settlement with East Palestine residents. EPA Administrator Michael Regan said the fine's the largest permitted under the Clean Water Act, but residents blasted it as a slap on the wrist. And Texas Congressmember Sheila Jackson Lee reintroduced the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act Thursday, 2 days ahead of the fourth anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Despite the national uprising that followed George Floyd's killing, Congress has failed to pass the legislation named in Floyd's memory, which seeks to reduce racial profiling and the use of force by law enforcement. At least 1,247 people were killed by police last year, more than any previous year on record. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
For more information on national and international news, go to democracynow.org. You're listening to KORC.
The Malheur National Wildlife Refuge is located south of the town of Burns in the Harney Basin. The main route to the headquarters is on Highway 205 for 26 miles, and then you head 6 miles east on Sod House Lane to this secluded location. It has several buildings located on the property, and this time of year is especially vibrant with wildlife, particularly birds, who are stopping off during their various migrations. The refuge has a few short trails and is situated overlooking a vast wetland and field where the public is not permitted. There are around 24 buildings, many now in various degrees of disrepair. The site was constructed in 1965 as a Job Corps youth camp before it lost its funding and closed 4 years later in 1969. It now serves as a national wildlife refuge, where wildlife comes first, and where people can experience the beauty of the natural world in a truly wild place. Back on January 2nd of 2016, an armed group of far-right extremists seized and occupied the headquarters of the National Wildlife Refuge here at Malheur. And it continued to occupy it until law enforcement made a final arrest on February 11th of 2016. The leader of this ragtag effort was Ammon Bundy, who participated in the 2014 Bundy standoff at his father's Nevada ranch. Other members of the group were loosely affiliated with various non-governmental militias and the Sovereign Citizen Movement. You've seen the videos of traffic stops with sovereign citizens, where a harebrained existential debate arises and usually results in their forceful arrest, instead of just handing over their license and registration. According to Wikipedia, the organizers were seeking an opportunity to advance their view that the federal government is constitutionally required to turn over most of the federal public land that they manage to the individual states, in particular, land managed by the Bureau of Land Management, also known as BLM, as well as the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, the United States Forest Service, and other agencies. In 2015, the militants believed that they could do this by protesting the treatment of two area ranchers in Burns, the Hammonds, who were convicted of federal land arson. They believed they were wrongly convicted, even though the two men in question, Dwight and Stephen Dwight Hammond, they were father and son, did not want the assistance of this group. The occupation began when Bundy led an armed party to the refuge headquarters following a peaceful public rally in the city of Burns. By February 11th, all of the militants had surrendered or withdrawn from the occupation, with several leaders having been arrested after leaving the site. One of them, Robert Lavoie Finicum, was shot and killed during an attempt to arrest him after he reached toward a handgun concealed in his pocket, after he tried to evade a roadblock. Ryan Bundy was wounded. More than two dozen of the militants were charged with federal offenses, including conspiracy to obstruct federal officers, firearms violations, theft, and depredation of federal property. By August of 2017, a dozen had pleaded guilty, and six of those had been sentenced to 1 to 2 years probation, some including house arrest. Seven others, including the leaders of this takeover, Ammon and Ryan Bundy, were tried and acquitted of all federal charges. Five more had been found guilty and were sentenced months later. Seven of the militants saw prison time for their roles in the occupation. Jake Ryan and Dwayne Amer each received 366 days in prison, with Ryan additionally getting 3 years of supervised probation. John Ritzheimer was sentenced to 366 days in federal prison and another 12 months in a residential reentry program. Two others, Joe O'Shaughnessy and Brian Cavalier, were detained for at least a year but released on time served plus 3 years of supervision each, and they also incurred some fines. The federal jury found brothers Ammon and Ryan Bundy and five others not guilty of conspiring to impede federal workers from doing their jobs during the 41-day armed takeover that ended on February 11th of 2016 at the refuge. Those of us who followed the case were appalled at the injustice, knowing full well that from the get-go, had this been people of color, perhaps a Muslim extremist group, a left-wing anarchist setup, the feds would have most certainly moved in with lethal force. The perps would have no chance to even see a trial in a courtroom. The precedent that was set by this national disgrace and legal failure has paved the way for what we saw on the day of the failed coup, January 6th, 2021, and perhaps worse to come. The Malheur National Wildlife Refuge is a beautiful place, one that should be protected not just for the natural world, but should have had a much better protection from a domestic terrorist ring who intimidated workers, desecrated the space, and clearly violated the law. Ammon Bundy's shenanigans didn't end with his acquittal from multiple legal offenses. During the COVID-19 pandemic, he was arrested more than five times for protests and disruption against COVID-19 mitigation efforts by the Idaho government. He ran for governor of Idaho in the 2022 election. He initially wanted to run as a Republican, but he decided instead to run as an independent in the general election, and he lost. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Krall at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, south of Burns, Oregon.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre with your Corvallis City meetings for the week of May 20th, 2024. On Monday, May 20th, the Corvallis City Council will be holding an executive session at 5:15 p.m. to discuss the status of a real estate property transaction. The meeting will be held in person at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. Also on Monday, May 20th, but at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a meeting. The meeting will be held in person at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. See CorvallisOregon.gov for agenda details and information on how to attend the meeting online. On Wednesday, May 22nd at 5 p.m., the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force meeting will be held at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. On Thursday, May 23rd at 4 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a work session which will be held virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
The Malheur National Wildlife Refuge is located south of the town of Burns in the Harney Basin. The main route to the headquarters is on Highway 205 for 26 miles, and then you head 6 miles east on Sod House Lane to this secluded location. It has several buildings located on the property, and this time of year is especially vibrant with wildlife, particularly birds, who are stopping off during their various migrations. The refuge has a few short trails and is situated overlooking a vast wetland and field where the public is not permitted. There are around 24 buildings, many now in various degrees of disrepair. The site was constructed in 1965 as a Job Corps youth camp before it lost its funding and closed 4 years later in 1969. It now serves as a national wildlife refuge, where wildlife comes first, and where people can experience the beauty of the natural world in a truly wild place. Back on January 2nd of 2016, an armed group of far-right extremists seized and occupied the headquarters of the National Wildlife Refuge here at Malheur. And it continued to occupy it until law enforcement made a final arrest on February 11th of 2016. The leader of this ragtag effort was Amon Bundy, who participated in the 2014 Bundy standoff at his father's Nevada ranch. Other members of the group were loosely affiliated with various non-governmental militias and the Sovereign Citizen Movement. You've seen the videos of traffic stops with sovereign citizens, where a harebrained existential debate arises and usually results in their forceful arrest, instead of just handing over their license and registration. According to Wikipedia, the organizers were seeking an opportunity to advance their view that the federal government is constitutionally required to turn over most of the federal public land that they manage to the individual states, in particular, land managed by the Bureau of Land Management, also known as BLM, as well as the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, the United States Forest Service, and other agencies. In 2015, the militants believed that they could do this by protesting the treatment of two area ranchers in Burns, the Hammonds, who were convicted of federal land arson. They believe they were wrongly convicted, even though the two men in question, Dwight and Stephen Dwight Hammond, they were father and son, did not want the assistance of this group. The occupation began when Bundy led an armed party to the refuge headquarters following a peaceful public rally in the city of Burns. By February 11th, all of the militants had surrendered or withdrawn from the occupation, with several leaders having been arrested after leaving the site. One of them, Robert Lavoy Finicum, was shot and killed during an attempt to arrest him after he reached toward a handgun concealed in his pocket. after he tried to evade a roadblock. Ryan Bundy was wounded. More than 24 of the militants were charged with federal offenses, including conspiracy to obstruct federal officers, firearms violations, theft, and depredation of federal property. By August of 2017, a dozen had pleaded guilty, and 6 of those had been sentenced to 1 to 2 years probation, some including house arrest. 7 others, including the leaders of this takeover, Ammon and Ryan Bundy, were tried and acquitted of all federal charges. 5 more had been found guilty and were sentenced months later. 7 of the militants saw prison time for their roles in the occupation. Jake Ryan and Dwayne Amer each received 366 days in prison, with Ryan additionally getting 3 years of supervised probation. John Ritzheimer was sentenced to 366 days in federal prison and another 12 months in a residential reentry program. 2 others, Joe O'Shaughnessy and Brian Cavalier, were detained for at least a year but released on time served plus 3 years of supervision each, and they also incurred some fines. The federal jury found brothers Ammon and Ryan Bundy and 5 others not guilty of conspiring to impede federal workers from doing their jobs during the 41-day armed takeover that ended on February 11th of 2016 at the refuge. Those of us who followed the case were appalled at the injustice, knowing full well that from the get-go, had this been people of color, perhaps a Muslim extremist group, a left-wing anarchist setup, the feds would have most certainly moved in with lethal force. The perps would have no chance to even see a trial in a courtroom. The precedent that was set by this national disgrace and legal failure has paved the way for what we saw on the day of the failed coup, January 6th, 2021, and perhaps worse to come. The Malheur National Wildlife Refuge is a beautiful place, one that should be protected not just for the natural world, but should have had a much better protection from a domestic terrorist ring who intimidated workers, desecrated the space, and clearly violated the law. Ammon Bundy's shenanigans didn't end with his acquittal from multiple legal offenses. During the COVID-19 pandemic, he was arrested more than 5 times for protests and disruption against COVID-19 mitigation efforts by the Idaho government. He ran for governor of Idaho in the 2022 election. He initially wanted to run as a Republican, but he decided instead to run as an independent in the general election, and he lost. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Krall at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, south of Burns, Oregon.
Hi neighbors, this is Claire Gilgannon here to talk with you about turkey vultures. Yes folks, you heard me correctly, I said turkey vultures. Those wonderful darlings of decay we often see soaring on thermals above our neighborhoods or in the wide open spaces of agricultural grasslands and riparian zones. Did you know that turkey vultures consume, nearly exclusively, the dead and decaying flesh of animals killed by disease, roadside collision, or natural causes? Yes, absolutely metal as fuck, I know. They lack the strength in their talons to grasp and kill live prey, so instead use their keen sense of sight and smell to locate their dead meals. By consuming decaying flesh, turkey vultures provide a key ecosystem service to all of us. Not only do they remove what would otherwise be left to rot, turkey vultures are also immune to many communicable diseases, including the rabies virus, which can infect pets, livestock, and humans, and is always fatal if left untreated. Turkey vultures don't give a fuck. They digest it and then even regurgitate it for their babies. And a turkey vulture that consumes infected meat effectively removes it from the environment, thereby reducing the presence of diseases that could otherwise harm us. So give them a break. take a moment to appreciate the next turkey vulture you spot. And if you see a turkey vulture feasting on a carcass alongside a road or highway, give them space. Change lanes if it's safe to do so, or slow down to reduce the chance the birds will attempt to take flight. Collision with vehicles injures and kills thousands of turkey vultures each year, and we need them around. Understand and respect their place in the ecosystem. You are listening to KORC.